The University Tower Chimes bring in another session of Ask the Professor, the show in which you match wits with University of Detroit Mercy professors in an unrehearsed session of questions and answers. I'm your host, Matt Mayo, and let me introduce to you our panel for today. To my left, from the first organization, it's Professor Dan Maggio.
Hi, Matt.
Any big plans for the weekend?
We have a little one-day curling tournament tomorrow.
Okay.
So I will be doing that, and hopefully that will be fun. And and on the Monday, I have the day off because I'll be celebrating my birthday.
Of course. So pre-birthday congratulations. 21
again. I'll be 21 again for the 29th time.
With experience. With experience.
For the 30th time.
All right. Very cool. Very cool.
Thank you.
Continuing around the table, just dropped a casual, gigantic announcement. Professor Joe Abbasid from Communication Studies.
You haven't been here in a while.
You haven't been here in
no,
a while,
I
Joe.
Haven't. And I apologize.
No, I mean, you do what you got to do, but apparently lots of things change when you're gone.
He's done wonders.
Yes, he has.
Thank you very much. And if everything goes well, next semester I'll be on family leave, which will be nice.
Very nice.
And we'll see how it goes.
Yes, I guess we will. I guess we will. Someone tweeted out something along the lines of, if anybody could encapsulate what it is to like have a newborn at home and what those first few days, weeks are like, that probably that the world would just distinguish itself and no people would ever be born ever again. I think it's a very Western perspective on raising children, but good luck. Hey, if you're on family leave and you want a couple hours off on a Friday afternoon, I think you know where to show up.
Yeah, I'll be looking to get out, I'm sure.
He's just looking for free babysitting with the panel here. That's
why the heck not?
No, my mom lives a few doors down, so
that's very nice.
Okay.
She'll be doing it, I guess. So
good luck with your preparations.
Thank you.
Continuing around the table, Professor Dave Chow is here from the College for Creative Studies.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
Excellent. Any big announcements, Dave?
No children, not that I know of.
All right.
None that I'm paying for. I got some top secret projects, which you might be interested in, but we'll talk about that off the air because I can't divulge too much yet.
Is it something to do with advertising things?
Possibly.
Is it underpants?
Possibly. No, I wish.
Why did you pick underpants?
Because he was involved in an underpants-based ad campaign.
Yes.
Dan, if you only knew some of the god-awful commercials I've worked on, you would probably lose all respect for me.
You mean your artwork could be all over my underwear?
Possibly. Oh, no. That underwear, I hope to God you'll never be wearing.
That's also true, yes. I also went right for the old Matt Groening, which says that you can increase the comedic value of the word by not saying underwear, but by saying underpants, which is 10 times more funny than underwear.
Or bloomers.
Bloomers, nice. Continuing around the table, Professor Mara Livesey is here from the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry.
Hello.
Hello. We were just having a friendly chat on the way over about how this semester is crushing our souls.
Truly.
Yes.
Do you have a soul?
I'm
not even pulling any punches.
Not anymore.
It's been crushed. It's in a shelf.
It's gone.
And last but most certainly not least, bringer of cupcakes. What other kennings do you want? Teacher of English, it is Professor Heather Velasquez.
Well, gee. Hello.
I use the word kenning today, and I'm very proud of myself.
I am quite impressed by that.
You are the bringer of cupcakes, though.
I did. I brought some cupcakes. No question.
Is it possible for you to extract some positivity from your last week or
not? Last week I had some excellent sessions in my classes in terms of discussion and
good.
Running out of time because of everybody wanting to talk.
That's great.
But this week there's been a general sort of
malaise,
exhaustion, glazed eyes, that kind of look. But I think there's kind of a general sadness on campus right now.
That is also true. So, we've had some unfortunate community losses just over the last 10 days.
But
we soldier on.
We soldier on.
Mm-hmm. Folks, this is a program. You can send us questions regarding anything. If you stump the panel, you win one of our prizes. And if you don't stump the panel, you win one of our prizes. You can send the questions to us in a number of ways. You can email us at atp@udmercy.edu. You can reach us on the web at udmercy.edu/atp. You can find us on Facebook, or if you're really daring, you can stare right at Alexa and say, Alexa, what's Dave Chow talking about?
And then suddenly,
you will hear his voice coming from your smart speaker.
You have to stare right at it?
Right at it. Retinal scan.
Oh, okay.
No, you have to ask for ATP, Detroit Mercy, or ask the professor Detroit Mercy, but you can hear our voices emanating from electronic devices in your home.
Creepy.
Totally creepy.
If my toaster starts speaking to me, I'm going to leave.
That was random. Okay.
Yes. We received a email missive from Eric E.
Missive? Jeez. Missive. Listen to you.
Eric E.
Kennings.
Mm-hmm.
Missives.
Good day, madams at sirs. Can you please help to possibly clear up a very contentious issue between myself and a dear friend? Is the word judgment considered misspelled in modern North American English? Everybody looks at the English professor?
No.
I don't think it is, and I think they're talking about that extra E in the middle.
There's no E.
There's no E in the American. There's an E in the British, I believe.
In the British? Yes. Okay.
Really?
That's totally ironic, as it is typed out in the email with the E. So maybe that's an inside joke. I don't know.
Are they children of the Commonwealth?
It does not say. We're happy to take individual questions every once in a while, especially Eric E., who signs emails most respectfully. I can't remember the last time a student sent me an email that said that.
Oh, my. Can we talk a little bit about email decorum, or can we talk about it forever?
Can I ask a related question? So we had a discussion last night at the club, and I've been told that irregardless is actually now a word in the dictionary.
It's quite possible.
And what are your thoughts, English
it's
professor,
misused.
On irregardless?
It's unnecessary to put the ear. Regardless is the correct word.
You're making your life harder by adding more syllables.
It's true. Like flammable and inflammable.
Well, my daughter insists that it's fine to keep you misusing the subjunctive because nobody really uses the subjunctive correctly anymore.
And for those of us who don't know anything about grammar, what is the subjunctive?
It's the difference between saying I was as opposed to I were.
Ah, yes.
For example, if I was to get a job, no, that's incorrect. If I were to get a job is the correct.
Is this like the Bigfoot of English right about
I could care less?
No, I didn't know anything about it.
This is more linguistic.
There are certain things that irritate me more than others, and the subjunctive is one of them.
Could you give us a list?
No, what irritates me? Ooh.
Careful. It's only a half-hour show. It's only a half-hour show.
I am now provoking Heather, which means I could possibly make the list.
This is not all I do, okay? This is not all that English professors do. It is a very small part of it.
You are the authority, though, for us. Though. We trust you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad this question got asked. It got us talking about all sorts of things, irregardless and what have you. Irregardless of what we do next, Kennings. We have a set of questions here. Dear profs, I've missed you dearly this semester and hope to join you this week on the air. However, I'm going to have to pick up my son at preschool.
Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jason.
Which gets just about the time we start to show. So I'll send you a few questions just for fun. I thought I'd send a few questions based on my midterm exam in VizCom, Visual Communication.
Ruh-roh.
Passing grade 60%. I'm sure you don't want to settle for a D. An A would be 90%. Good luck, Professor J.J.R. Yes, Jason Roach has sent us some questions. I think they're all about symbology. Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, 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 dun.
The term semiotics refers to the study of what?
Symbols.
Symbols and signs, that's right. Semiotics. There's even a branch of organic chemistry called semi-chemistry.
Really?
We talk about...
tell me. Do tell.
It's all about sending signals, basically. Yep.
Cool.
So that's the way they use the word. It's cool.
You mean using chemistry to make signals?
Well, think about it from the perspective of a hormone in your body is also a signal molecule.
Gotcha.
So things like that. Mm-hmm. What is the rhetorical term for when we use a part of something to refer to the whole or the whole of something to refer to a part? Here are some examples. Saying Madison Avenue when referring to the advertising industry, Hollywood to refer to the film industry, or the Kremlin...
Ooh.
To refer to the government of the country of Russia. What is that called?
I do not.
This is one of my top three, I'm about to embarrass myself, mispronunciations.
Does it begin with an E?
It does not. It starts with the letter S.
Then I am on the wrong path.
We have a visual communications artist and a communication studies prof. So this is going to be interesting.
Yeah, guys.
Like semantic
syllogism?
Not no. Syllogism. I think that Beth would chime in if she was here with that. That's a statement of probable logic.
Silly string. No.
It says here the answer is
Schenectady.
Wait, but that's a city in upstate New York, isn't it?
Schenectady.
Schenectady.
Yes. Schenectady.
I've been there, Schenectady.
They got a Greek fish fry there. If we break down the Greek, it means same meaning is what it means. So, I totally blew it up. S-Y-N-E-C-D-O-C-H-E. Yeah, Schenectady.
Saying it's easier than spelling it.
Yeah, seriously. Ugh, what a mess.
Cool.
Okay. What is the true definition of the word icon, such as the picture of a heart that's drawn with arteries and veins attached? What is an icon?
It's a representation of...
It's a representation of what it stands for. That's right.
As opposed to a pop icon?
Which is a representation for what?
Something we all want to be.
I'm glad it was followed with a chuckle. That's for sure. Holy smokes.
So it's an abstract of a realistic object.
That's right.
Abstract.
The symbol, yes. As opposed to the pop icon. Right.
One of my favorite bits from lecture is drawing the three bars for butane on the board and asking my students what it is, and they all say that it's butane because it's a symbol for butane, but I said it's marker on the board, actually. So we use models in science. That's the last thing that I heard about it.
Well, it's like in this building, when you walk in one of the doors, there's a sign on the door or on the glass window that says, post no paper signs on this door, on a piece of paper.
This page intentionally left blank.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I wonder what the term for that is.
Oh, man. I really hope it's not one of the future questions.
Besides meta.
Yikes. Yeah, it's pretty meta. That's for sure. How do we define an indexical sign?
Indexical.
Able to be indexed?
I'm going partial credit on that.
That sounds good to
me. But you're going to need to go one step deeper into possibly the definition of index.
Can it be categorized? Is that how
close.
Topic list.
Put on an index card.
Dewey Decimal System.
How about if I told you that indexical or index is actually the opposite in many ways of icon? Would that help?
Index
is the opposite.
An actual index card.
It's got to be literal?
If icon is a visual representation of an actual thing, then the index would be an actual thing representing an icon.
I think that we're going to take a break before I reveal what's going on here. And we're back. This is smoking the profs here. How do we define an indexical sign or index? So an icon resembles what it stands for, but an indexical sign does not look like what it represents.
Oh.
But there's always a logical connection. He says, for example, if you saw a picture of someone clutching their chest and leaning over, you might think...
Fred Sanford.
Heart attack. We certainly don't read that symbol as heart attack. We still do, but it doesn't mean the words heart attack. It's kind of interesting. Let's see. How are symbols different from indexical signs or iconic signs?
Didn't you just answer that?
No, actually, this is another layer that we're adding to it. I wish I would have taken VizCom. This is fun. Think of a classic symbol like a stop sign. How is that different from something that's an icon or an index?
Because it doesn't actually represent something real.
Exactly. It's a logical connection.
Abstract.
And the key thing about a symbol is it must be learned. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you would never know.
Okay,
what
so it's
meant.
A cultural
yes.
thing. Okay.
Yes.
So in other words, like the stop sign in Western culture means stop, whereas you might take it to a different planet, it might mean...
Go.
Fertility or whatever. I don't know.
Right. It's ideological.
Yes. I think that's one way to put it. How about we go another layer deeper? And Jason asks us, what's meant by the term intertextuality? Intertextuality.
Between texts?
Yes.
Communication
also
between.
Partial credit.
Yes.
Can you give an example?
Yes.
No.
That would be helpful.
Intertextuality?
Intertextuality, yes.
Go, Joe, go.
Between two texts is exactly right, but can you give us an example?
Does it mean to gloss a text?
No, no, that not, doesn't know what it means. What if I said West Side Story and Romeo and Juliet?
They're the same story.
It's basically the same thing. When one art form borrows from another, the other example given here is Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, and the Japanese film The Hidden Fortress. So it's basically the same thing.
Really?
Different timetables, yes.
So there's another movie out there like Star Wars?
Yeah.
Cool.
Very old movie.
You know, like Kimba and the Lion King.
Oh, Kimba and the Lion King.
That was too close.
Those are really
close. Too close. Way too close.
Crazy. Just saw that internet video this week, too. It's almost like mind-blowing. The poor guy's dog is watching Mufasa's death scene and clearly having like hardcore emotions about it. Like he keeps getting up and sitting down and whimpering, like seeing the little lion run around his dead dad. Yes, make sure to check that out on the internet.
How about Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and Get Out?
Okay. Yeah, very nice. Yes. Very nice.
Because I teach those two movies together right now.
It makes me very excited. I'm going to see Jordan Peele's Us tonight. Tomorrow. I cannot wait.
Oh, yeah.
Going
tomorrow, too.
Can't wait.
I'm very excited.
Yes.
I hope he continues to make movies for a very long time.
Me too.
Yes.
Yes, I hope he does not turn into the next M. Night Shyamalan. According to art historian Arthur Gowans, what are the four functions of art? I'll even give you the whole, let's see if we can get two of them.
Matches the sofa.
It moves the soul.
Pleasure.
Let's see.
Crushes the soul.
I'm going to give Mara moves the soul. Beautification is the term. Beautification.
Okay. Thought provoking.
Yep.
Thought provoking. I'm going to give you persuasion conviction, and we just hit the magic thing. You think you get some bonus points here?
Representation of culture.
Improves life.
Representation of culture. I've got substitute imagery, or we could interpret illustration. And I don't know.
Creates justice, makes life better, creates...
Informs?
I don't know.
Yeah. Communicates...
Substitute imagery, illustration, persuasion, conviction, beautification. You guys hit all the major notes. All the major notes.
Yeah, he's a hack. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He makes that up. I mean,
according to Heather Hill Vasquez, I mean, it's like this guy's definitions.
Well, it's like you know, putting, you know, so he's going to look at a piece of art and put it on some sort of a scale.
Right,
he gives it like, you know, a two for this and a three for that. And
and what movie does that make you think of? Come on.
Robin Williams. What is that movie?
Yes, Dead Poets Society. The angle of the...
It's got a three, but you can't dance to it.
How important the poem was actually had a rating system
associated
with it.
Yes, that's what I was actually thinking of. Thank you for reading my mind, Matt Mile.
Love it. According to sociologist Herbert Gans, oh man, we're doing another one of these guys. What are the five taste cultures in art in the U.S.? Oh my.
In the U.S.?
Taste cultures?
Yes.
Postmodernism?
Oh my.
Neoclassicism?
Am I getting close to it at all?
No.
Abstract.
Representational?
I will sort of take the hat off this thing by saying Gans did not judge any of these as superior to the other, but argued that our socioeconomic status plays a significant role in our taste in art. Oh, this is horrible.
Could you repeat the question?
According to sociologist Herbert Gans, what are the five taste cultures in art in the United States?
High, low, and medium?
Basically, you got full credit. I have high, upper middle, lower, low, and quasi-folk.
Ooh. What?
Quasi-folk means you're crawling on the ground and eating grubs.
Yeah, basically. So, and so your artist, too.
High art.
High, upper middle, low, so lower middle, low, and quasi-folk.
So what would be something that would be classified as high art? Like a...
Yeah.
Like opera.
Like a painting?
Yeah, but then as far as I'm concerned, if somebody wants to buy something I made for $1 billion, it doesn't necessarily make it high art.
No, but seriously... My 7-year-old can make a painting too, but I don't think it qualifies as high culture. It's probably quasi-folk.
But it could. That's all really based on selling price.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's basically
something. A piece of art's worth is
what you can get for it.
What you can get for it, right?
Yeah.
If it's a piece of crap, but it sells for $1 million, that's high art.
Yeah,
I guess it is.
Or, you know, and it doesn't even take into craft into consideration. You know, like if you spent 1,000 hours on it, is it better than your 7-year-old spending 2 seconds with it?
I go to some of my favorite art of all time to back you up, Mondrian. I'm sorry. I'm moved by that stuff. Mm-hmm. But some people are like, that is a box that's colored blue.
I love that stuff, too.
I love that stuff. I think it's fun.
Or I love Brancusi.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we've learned some things about Herbert Gans and Arthur Gowans today. We don't know if we like it or not.
I say we take them in back and like get tube socks full of oranges and pummel them.
What is the term for messages designed to bypass our conscious minds?
Subliminal.
Subliminal, sneaky. Yes. I can't help but not let this roll by without bringing up...
Are you thinking of John Lovitz?
No, I was thinking of a classic Simpsons that was that the military was recruiting using subliminal, liminal, and superliminal. Superliminal meant opening the window to your office and yelling, "Join the army!" Just out the window.
Clown College. Remember?
Oh, there
clown
we go.
College.
Just to teach subliminal influence, we talk about it in Persuasion.
Oh, sure.
There's no evidence for any.
Oh, really? Interesting.
It's all popular culture.
Yeah, like the word sex written on the Ritz crackers and things like that.
Or the camel cigarettes thing. Yeah.
There isn't any empirical evidence that shows subliminal influence.
Okay.
And as a person who's in that field
who's
got to create those images.
There isn't any evidence, but the ad campaigns are doing it on purpose, correct?
They may be doing it, but if audiences don't process it. So liman just is the threshold of awareness.
Oh. So it exists in the sense that people think it might work, but it doesn't exist in the sense that it doesn't seem to actually be effective. Hmm. The intent is there.
I don't know if it even exists.
Yeah.
The intent has to exist if somebody is actually drawing a camel that looks like
something else.
Nice reference from American history.
Right.
Thank you.
It's possible that there are people trying to influence, but there's just no evidence that people are influenced by subliminal
messages. Okay, that's the distinction.
Yes. Does the method make a difference? When you make a determination whether it's effective or not, does it depend on the method? For example, if you put a frame of "buy Pepsi" every 10th frame of a movie, does that method, is that different than drawing a camel to look like something else?
Listen to ATP.
Send money to Dave.
The history of subliminal influence, there was some movie in the 50s called Picnic, where apparently there was buy popcorn or buy Coke or whatever it was, and then people were really hungry.
Sales went up at intermission,
supposedly. It's all fake. None of it is real.
Okay.
It may have happened, but it's all anecdotal.
Yeah.
But it just does not exist.
Interesting.
Like, there's the prime example. Was it there's one of those Disney posters that supposedly somebody painted something in the background. Well, guess what? That was one of my friends who did that poster.
And it was not.
He had less than 24 hours to paint that painting, and he found out in church. Somebody down the pew said, "Hey, did you paint what I thought I saw?" He says, "What are you talking about?
Oh, for Pete's sake. That's incredible."
Then he started reading what people were saying about it. I had no idea. I was just rushed on a deadline, and people implied every third thing, but that was never his intent.
Very interesting. So, we do have one more question here. What's the name of the style of lighting for paintings, photographs, film, video, etc., that was made popular by Rembrandt? And what it means is to appear as having only one light source. Yes, chiaroscuro. The hint was, it's not Dutch, it's Italian.
We can only afford one light bulb.
That's right. It was called the sun, you know. Professor JJR says, "I always put a bonus question on my exams. Here's one for the profs, just in case you need to boost your grade."
Oh, boy, do we ever.
No penalty if you get it wrong. What are the two Freudian themes that frequently occur in subliminal messages in advertising, even though they don't have any effect on the human populace?
Oedipal.
Don't think too hard.
So it has to do with sex.
Sex is one of them, yes.
Sex sells.
Oh, so just, okay.
And the other, you know, thing that happens to us all.
Death.
There we go.
Taxes.
We've got
taxes
all the bases covered.
Watch ATP. Listen to ATP. Think ATP.
I know exactly what you're referring to, Joe, with regard to there being no actual empirical data that says that subliminal, but I feel like it's not just like a zeitgeist. Like, people still do it to this day, saying that it has power, even if there's data that contradicts that.
It's sort of one of the few academic theories or academic interests that has a lot of popular currency. Mm-hmm. People like to believe that it works because people believe in this power of advertising, and that we do all these things because advertisers are super sneaky and that we just can't resist it. But I've never seen any empirical evidence in the persuasion research literature. That's,
yeah, and even anything. From a person who does the imagery, I don't have time to sneak that stuff in there.
Yeah.
I just don't have time.
Clearly.
Yeah. I mean, there was one ad, this happened a long, long time ago before I even started school. There's a Comerica ad. It was one of those scenes where they would show every Comerica bank in the city of Detroit. And the illustrator put in this, like, this one little figure of a guy holding a gun up in front of Comerica. And they end up getting sued for it because, you know, that slipped through. Because that illustration was so complex. That slipped through everyone's hands and that poor guy, you know, lost his job.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, there'd be a pretty big backlash.
Oh, yeah. And then they actually made the studio buy an ad in the Free Press and News apologizing.
Unbelievable.
Cost them a fortune.
I bet it did.
To apologize.
Let's end on a positive note here. It's time to play the ATP favorites game. And today, our favorite is, what is your favorite thing that happens or thing about spring?
Baseball season starting.
Baseball! Yes, okay, baseball.
Notice I didn't 100%. Say Tigers.
It's okay.
All of baseball.
The Red Sox are going to defend their World Series championship.
I don't know. The Yankees are looking pretty good. Not gonna lie.
Everybody hates the Yankees. Okay, what is your favorite thing about spring?
I take the car out and go cruising. So
yes,
I
you
get
do.
To go on my staycation up and down Woodward.
Mm-hmm.
So
I suppose I should say gardening, but I'm
yeah.
So
I was going to say gardening, and you can open up the windows.
Oh yeah,
finally get
always good. What do you think, Joe?
Going to the movies.
You go to the movies in the spring?
You could do that
spring.
In the winter.
Yeah, I was going to say
summer.
Well, summer.
Yeah, but there's
summer
a different kind of movie that's out at this time of year, right?
Right. Yeah.
We get blockbusters now basically at the end of April, including this year with the Avengers sequel coming out. So, anybody see Captain Marvel yet? That was pretty good, too.
I have to see it because I might want to use it in class.
Oh,
in
yeah,
fall.
You want to use it in class.
I was gonna say.
Is it good?
It's good. It's very good. Mara, spring has sprung.
Spring has sprung, mm-hmm. And I am looking forward to going to the farmer's market.
Yes.
What a great thing. Absolutely. So what's going to be some of the first things you can buy? Like
flowers, more flowers and flowers.
Flowers.
Asparagus is fairly early.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Strawberries come later,
strawberries.
But fairly early.
Yep.
Yep. Strawberries are June.
Yeah.
Another raspberries, reason. July.
Yeah, then all those berries. Tasty berries a little later. Yeah.
I actually chart strawberry season specifically by waiting for the ads from Big Boy, and that pretty much takes care of business. It's a strawberry festival or whatever.
They come in here,
so. I'll have a Slim Jim. I'm afraid, apparently it's time for us to say goodbye, and not a moment too soon. Heather.
Listen to ATP.
Mara.
See ya.
Dave.
See ya.
Joe.
Take care.
Dan.
Goodbye.
And now these words.
You can email Ask the Professor at atp@udmercy.edu. Tweet to us on Twitter at Ask the Professor or using the hashtag AskTheProfessorUDM or visit the Ask the Professor Facebook page.
Ask the Professor is transcribed in the facilities of the Briggs Building and the Department of Communication Studies and the College of Liberal Arts and Education at the University of Detroit Mercy's McNichols campus. Ask the Professor is produced and technically directed today by Brian Masonville, and our executive producer is Dr. Vivian Dix. Until next week, I'm your host, Matt Mayo.